Well, now, first up, to a little-heard take on how we'd be wise to fiddle with our repeated discussions around multiculturalism, pluralism and so on, to be explicit about the emotions of the majority group within a nation, as well as the aspirations of the minorities. In fact, it's that very word nation that preoccupies Dr. Michael Skye, my first guest this hour, because he doesn't believe there's nearly enough curiosity about the codes and tastes that help people identify with one nation or another. And with the London Olympics getting closer, it's a good chance, he suggests, to really think through why we'll all be barracking for people we've never met, know little about, except that they're wearing a uniform that depicts they're from Australia. And in migrant countries like ours especially, he believes it's terribly important to name why and who is seen as belonging to a country and how this is decided. Risky too, some might suggest, but to help us understand why he's not afraid to go right into these sensitive quandaries, I'd like to welcome Dr. Skye. He lectures in sociology at the University of East London, and his research is in the area of national identity and globalisation. Hello and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Is it risky territory?
It is a little bit, yes. I mean, when people find out that you're researching nationalism, a lot of the time they say things like, oh, so how are you getting on with your friends in the British National Party, for example? So nationalism is for many people associated with kind of far-right movements and political violence and so on and so forth. And I guess my argument is that we need to understand why belonging to a nation is important to certain people. It's not important to everyone.
Is it important to you?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I do get stupidly excited when the English football team win or the English cricket team win. So, yes, it, in some ways it is important to me. So, I mean, I do try and adopt a kind of critical perspective, but I've been brought up English. I enjoy many aspects of English culture, and when I go to other countries, they do seem a little bit odd and alien to me. So yeah, in some ways it is important to me. And in being able to acknowledge that, I think it enables you to get an insight into why these forms of solidarity and community matter.
I suppose we take it for granted, really, these days, since the days of nations arising, which is, what, about 400 years, I suppose, that we live and belong to a nation, that we do a lot of talking, particularly in the chattering classes, about multiculturalism and integration, which worries us.
Yeah.
Why do we need to identify and be explicit, if I'm hearing you correctly, more about what the majority group tastes are? Why does that matter?
Because in all of these debates around cohesion and integration and inclusion, the focus is almost always on minorities. It's about what they do, what they don't do, and what they should do. But all of these kind of metaphors imply that there's more than one group involved. They have to integrate with something. And we need to understand who is the something that they have to integrate with and what's at stake for them. These are the people that kind of position themselves as the ones who can make judgments. They are at the heart of the nation. That's the way in which they talk. That's the way in which they position themselves. So a lot of the research shows that among ethnic minorities in, say, Britain or Australia, they're quite happy to identify as Australian, but a lot of the time they're not recognised as being Australian enough or British enough by majority groups, and we need to understand why that is.
And how would you make sure that you don't drift into exclusive type conduct by identifying? I can imagine this is what people would say, was by naming these things, you actually effortlessly name who doesn't belong as opposed to who does belong.
I think I try and make a distinction between understanding the views that are put forward. And some of these views are quite nasty. You know, some of them are racist, some of them are prejudiced. But we have to make a distinction between trying to understand what these views offer and condoning what they're saying.
See, I remember a few years ago, and I was actually at a dinner here in Sydney, where John Prescott, who was then the Deputy Prime Minister under Blair, I think, mm-hmm. very sort of doughty character.
Yep.
This was when people were saying there ought to be, and we've had the same debate here, almost like a test you passed, a sort of an understanding of what makes Australian culture, Australia, and the same thing was being said in England, before people are admitted as full citizens. And he hated that idea. And it was a hugely emotive debate in England, as here. Oh, you know, you'll end up asking them, you know, can they spell Bradman? How pathetic.
Yeah.
Now, I always felt there was quite a lot more to be said for that, and I even thought the migrants would have liked it. I mean, is this what you're talking about?
Well, not especially. I mean, I think there's some argument for having migrants come in with say, language skills. Because in order to participate in a society in a full way, you have to be able to speak to your fellow citizens. But I think with, you know, in Britain we have the citizenship test now, and it's a whole host of multiple choice answers that if you gave to me, for example, as a born and bred British person, you know, I might struggle with some of them. Does that make me less British if I can't pass this test?
No, but it might be, that's the classic answer, but might it not, following your argument through, be a useful way of naming and being explicit about what does constitute the innards of a country's culture? What's the matter with doing that?
But I think it's problematic because in trying to name what it means to be British, you come up with a normative list, a kind of shopping list. And that excludes people in the process of doing that. You know, people who don't identify the things on the list, therefore don't count as British.
So, but I thought that list of yours would be go to the majority taste.
No, I don't think so. No.
Well,
no.
So what do you mean by majority tastes and majority codes?
It's the people that have been brought up within a particular nation, say Britain, and who take for granted that they belong there. Mm. And they define their belonging in relation to other groups that
they don't see.
Yes. And in doing that, they are offered a really valuable sense of who they are. They are able to position themselves in a hierarchy above other groups. And for certain groups, I mean, the white working class in Britain is the obvious one. Their other sources of solidarity and community have been chipped away over the past 30, 40 years. So often what they're left with is the nation as a means of giving them a sense of power and agency and control. So I think those shopping lists, they're problematic.
I wonder if it's difficult for a certain type of person to
possibly,
do it.
Possibly.
And that actually there's a broader group who wouldn't find it hard. Do you see what I mean? It particularly picks a scab of sort of, I will be considered trying to exclude others. When I wonder if it means that at all.
Yeah, but
like if you're nominated at a barbecue for the sake of argument, or if you're not nominated at a capacity for fairness, would that matter? What's the matter with nominating that for the sake of argument?
Well, you know, okay then, so what about the people who can't stand barbecues? Do they not count as Australian? I mean, how many do you need on that list? Do you need 7 out of 10 and then you count as an Australian? It's really problematic, and this is part of the problem of trying to understand why nations and national identities do matter so much, is because when you try and pull them apart and see what the workings are, there's nothing obvious to get hold of.
But then all big emotions, the intangibility of all manner of huge affiliations are very difficult to put words to.
Absolutely. I think they get their meaning when you take them. You know, this idea of community gets its meaning when by and large people take for granted what's around them. Once you pin it down and try to dissect it, it kind of falls away.
Let me just tell people who you are. Who's saying all these things? My guest is Dr. Michael Skye. He lectures in sociology at the University of East London, and he's interested in the notion of nationhood. Tell us how you believe, and your research has come to persuade you, that is it that people are sort of floating free a little bit with the process of globalisation and the technology revolution? They need these affiliations, you think?
In the British case, I think there's an argument to be made that in the post-war era, there was a more or less secure sense of Britishness. With the changes that are happening around the world with globalisation, the increasing mobility of people, the impact of the media, this sense of security that comes from having a more or less stable national identity comes under threat, and it provokes an increasing sense of anxiety amongst people who pretty much took their national identity for granted. And so in the British case, and I think it can be argued around other nations in Western Europe, in the States, in Canada and in Australia, what we're seeing is a kind of backlash from these groups. And you could argue that the flag waving that's now happening is part of this response of trying to reassert their sense of national identity. This is our country. It's important to us. Our sense of belonging to the nation matters. and we are going to display it.
And what's your essential judgment about that? You think that this should be taken more seriously?
Yeah, I do think it. Again, I don't want to say that people who are making arguments against minorities that we should condone what they're saying, but I think we should take their arguments seriously, because if we simply dismiss them, how does that help us generate a more cohesive society?
One of the greatest epithets you can throw at somebody is in here is to say that is un-Australian behaviour. I haven't heard of un-English behaviour, but it's regarded as there's a certain core level of conduct that is required of Australia. Now, again, trying to pin down what that means.
Absolutely, yeah.
Who does this, by the way? Do politicians do this?
Well, I think politicians need to address these concerns of majority groups. Yeah, they need to understand if you're proposing a new way of conceiving of what it means to be Australian, that is much more open, that includes a whole variety of different people with different practices and different tastes and different values, then those who've previously been at the heart of the nation need to be taken with you. Otherwise, they're going to react in a very antagonistic way. And so politicians and policymakers and academics and, you know, media commentators to some degree need to be aware that, you know, the majority are part of this debate.
I suppose that's where sport comes into it. It's nationalism in its most obviously cohesive form,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, I mean, let me give you an example of what goes on in Britain and how it's becoming much more complex. I mean, I play soccer, as you call it, on a weekly basis in East London with a bunch of guys who are mainly from a Bengali background. In football, they support England with a passion. When it comes to cricket, they support Bangladesh. Now, someone from the majority might argue, well, hang on a minute, they've been born in England, they've been brought up in England, why aren't they supporting England? And there needs to be a debate between these groups about, you know, why these guys are, you know, they're not necessarily antagonistic towards everything about England, but they also have these other values that they draw in as well. Mm. But I think we
Can I just suggest to you, I don't know that there's a resolution to that, and that's why everybody leaves it alone. Because, you know, you could mount a very good argument to those Bengalis. No, you are here now. You're probably drawing all sorts of checks from England. You've got to give that up. But no one wants to do that because it's too hard.
You know, I think that these guys are contributing. They're all employed, they're all in the education system, they all speak English, they participate in society in a way that I think most people would find acceptable. They, however, have partial allegiance to another part of the world, but we can acknowledge that as part of a dialogue that takes in some of the majority concerns, but also acknowledges that these people do have allegiances not only to England, but to other countries.
Just quickly, when have you seen it done well? Is there an instance you can cite me of a debate you've seen anywhere in the West that has done it well?
It's actually quite hard to find it. I mean, in Britain, these debates tend to be crippled by nostalgia for the past. You know, World War II, the Empire, etc., etc. I think it's done well in terms of small NGOs, charities working on the ground, bringing people together. Because obviously that's, you know, that's where people engage with each other. So a classic example, I think, would be the National Health Service in Britain, where you've got a whole range of different people getting on with things together. You've got doctors from around the world treating local patients, and they come together and they engage with each other. So I think that's a really interesting example of where this diversity is managed and managed well.
But in policy terms,
it's difficult to find example.
I think the AFL in Australia, our football league, is probably one of the very best examples. I think it's the sort of thing our listeners can actually let us know, because it's a very interesting argument. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michael Skye. He works at the University of East London, where he's a sociologist, and his book is National Belonging and Everyday Life, The Significance of Nationhood in an Uncertain World. It's a Palgrave Macmillan publication. And as I suggested, I'm very keen to hear your thoughts about nationalism. You could go to our website, call us on the listener line, 02-833-5975, email us, or tweet at Geraldine Doogue.